to Best Love Films, the podcast that goes with bestlovefilms.com. Let's begin by acknowledging that this land, the United States of America, was stewarded beautifully by thousands, was it thousands? It may have been just hundreds of generations of Native Americans before any white people showed up. Let's all thank them for that. Promise to try to leave this land a little bit better. Okay, my name is Daniel Smith Rousey. I am a filmmaker, media scholar, published books the traditional way. My stuff's on YouTube. Anyway, you know all that, or else you wouldn't be here. This is kind of exciting for me. I mean, we're here. This is it. This is the, I want to say, 20th podcast of this season. 20th and final. So of this fifth season. I mean, we've done a lot here. I set out this organization of A-list, B-list, C-list, D-list, E-list, and we've done it. I mean, that's kind of crazy, you know? I like a lot of podcasts, but they're not always that well organized. They've got a lot of other things to recommend them that this one doesn't, and that's fair. You know what? Yep, they got the bells, they got the whistles, they got the guests, they got the Nobel Prize winners. They got all kinds of things. I mean, they got things. What do we have? We have organization. That's right. And we also don't do deep dives into films. I mean, I think sometimes I'm like, maybe we should be doing a deeper dive here. It's kind of that shallow surface level. But there is something to that, too. Let's face it. Shallow surface is not nothing. These could be called medium dives. They are to some people. Maybe you're one of those people listening to this going, man, why don't we take 3 hours to talk about this 1 2-minute film? Sure. Okay. But you do recognize that not everybody feels that way, right? Anyway, I like this, obviously, or I wouldn't be doing it. I love, I'm a person who's very lucky that I get to do some of what I like to do. Okay, but let's get back to the experimental list. There is something important to talk about, and I've been signposting this now for a while. So why does this list end in 2002? Yes, that is a great question. Oh, well, wait, okay, I'm kind of pinballing around. Let me just mention what the five films are going to be for today. The E96 through EU100, okay? So what are the last of the films? They are A-U-I-E-O-N, I'm saying that in kind of an English way, which is a little problematic. And okay, that movie, Quest is the second one, Rejected is the third one, Decacia is the fourth one, and then Russian Ark will be E-100. Okay, now, Russian Ark, Decacia, they came out in 2002. As I record this, it's 2024, 22 years of other avant-garde films. Why aren't we seeing any of them? That's a reasonable question. I had actually decided this a long time ago, years ago when I was creating these lists in the first place. I do think, I mean, you could make a case, but I kind of, you know, I'm guided, even though I had thought of this way in advance, I'm guided by, there's been a lot of talk about stuck culture. You can Google that. One article that I love about stuck culture is Jason Farago's, it's like a 27 paragraph article, kind of long. You could just, if you Google those words, Jason Farago, F-A-R-A-G-O, he's a writer for the New York Times. A culture critic, yes, there are such people, where he talks about how, let me just quote him right here. Well, he's talking about how film is not as transgressive anymore for a lot of reasons. I'm just going to read aloud one thing he says. It may just be that the lexical possibilities of many traditional media are exhausted, and there's no shame in that. Maybe Griffith and Eisenstein and Godard and Ackerman did it already, and it's foolish to expect a new kind of cinema. Certainly that exhaustion came long ago to abstract painting, where every possible move can only be understood as a quotation or reboot. Okay, unquote. That's a crucial phrase, what he just said about abstract painting, because let's face it, experimental film is basically where cinema meets abstract painting. Yes, we could problematize that a little bit, but there is something to that, something irreducibly true about that. And It's also irreducibly true that when you're in a modern art museum these days and you go from room to room, you might go through the 50s, the Jackson Pollocks, you might see some things from the 60s, you might see some Andy Warhols, 70s, 80s. You're going to start to notice when you get to the 90s and then after, it's not the things aren't changing that much. And that's kind of what we're talking about here on this podcast. There just isn't quite enough change. Now, I know somebody's gonna say, oh, but what about this artist who's awesome from more recent times? I get that. There are awesome artists, but they're just not quite pushing the boundaries of experimental film the way that Dali, Maya Deren, Stan Brakhage, a bunch of these other people did that we were talking about throughout this semester. What am I talking about semester? It's been a season on a podcast. Anyway, so I defend this. I think it's defensible to wrap up here. Plus, I kind of like wrapping up with the 100th film that I have chosen because it's sort of a nice way to finish everything off. Yes, there are limited experiments along the edges. There's more representation, and that's great. But I think it's defensible to say that most of the abstract and sort of the non-narrative explorations have kind of been done. It's variations on a theme, is what I would say. I mean, roughly. Of course, it's easy for me to say that. I'm a white guy. There's always going to be people who disagree with that. But I do think, yeah, they kind of knocked down the door. Even just the last 10 or 15 films we've talked about in this podcast have been not quite as boundary pushing in many ways as the ones prior to them. So it's already there's a sort of a slowing of transgressiveness. I mean, not entirely. I mean, this makes it sound like I'm this feels like such a throw of splash of water over all the good and vital work being done. I do think, there's another thing too, which I want to say is that a lot of it is just not easily transmitted on as something you could find on YouTube these days anyway. I mean, that's the thing. You have these video, these things in museums. If you go, there might be like one wall is taken up of this other wall is taken up of that, these 3D things. They don't translate well as to what you can see in your digital museum of film. Therefore, they don't really work on this list. I mean, that's the thing is like the great and vital artists, they're kind of doing other things with video. Video is being incorporated into this other experiential thing. Video games are. So yes, there are things happening, and they're exciting things, but they don't quite work for this list. In the end, I think experimental movies are kind of a mode. They're kind of they're trying to do a certain thing generally. They're pushing the boundaries, but they're also, they're not narrative. They're kind of, making us ask questions about the difference between sort of documentary and, I mean, what are most films doing? They're not documentary, they're not narrative, they're neither. And they're this great vanguard to say, okay, that film could also do these other things. And yeah, other people take from them. I think you start with this 100. Maybe, there's going to be others. There's going to be other lists. There's going to be other nonfiction lists. Maybe we'll see some other experimental films from more recent times when we get to the end list, for example. I think that's where we should leave this at that point. Okay, but anyway, let's get to these. Let's get to our final ones. This is so exciting. Wow, we've done a whole nother season. I love that. Oh, well, should I be signposting the next season? Because we may change up the game a little bit for next season, but I don't want to get too much. I love my changes because, why not? Okay. Anyway, Takahiko Imura. Have you heard of him? Great. He's been one of Japan's most important and influential avant-garde artists since his career began in the 1960s. Imura is also known for his support of other filmmakers. He wrote a book about experimental filmmaking in 1970 and a biography of Yoko Ono in 1985. Like Ono, he's basically spent a career, he spent a whole career in Japan and a whole career in New York. I mean, at least the equivalent of one, So it's kind of impressive the work he's done. His stuff is really good. I had various access issues trying to find something to show from his earlier periods. So I eventually settled on this, which is not the most representative of his films, and I may change it later this list depending on what becomes available. Okay. This was like a thing he did for this thing. They wanted 1 minute shorts. He contributed this. It was shortly after the like Michael Jackson video for Black and White, and this idea of like morphing and trying to use that as a sort of an emotional thing. Okay, but anyway, so this particular film of his, AUIEON, it's based on these, you know, these are. It's Japanese. They associate each, you know, each sound in Japanese is transliterated into, you know, a Roman letter. This is Imura's little take on that. Okay, anyway, the film begins with A and a spirited man in close up looking at the camera and opening his mouth for a much wider ah than real life allows. As he holds it, his face balloons and his eyebrows rise in exaggerated ways. The I, pronounced E, is done with an overwidened, even sad mouth. As the eyes dart, the eyes are kind of, you know, going from one thing to another. For the U, which is pronounced ooh, the face stretches from the middle in four diagonal directions, giving the impression of crossed eyebrows and a deeply unhappy mouth. For the E, pronounced like the E in get, he sticks out his widened tongue and his ears flap like an elephant cooling off. For the O, the eyes get buggy and the rounded mouth gets rounder with fuller lips. The N does things we haven't yet seen, pushing in from the top of the man's head to make a few semi-Vs as his lips stretch on the N. This is just one level of his transgressions. He's had a lot of others, many of which were probably more interesting. Shuji Teriyama, why did this say Shuji? And Takahiko Imura made avant-garde films in general that feel like they could not have been made in the West, expanding the language beyond how others expanded it. So it's important and vital that we know that they're there. And that their stuff is there, and that we go back and look for it, as I will go back and do myself. Okay, so that's about as much as I want to say. That knock that one out quick. During the 20th century, many countries had many non-digital animation departments. One of the best ones was at University of Kassel, in Germany. Animators Tyron Montgomery and Thomas Stelmach made their magnum opus in 1996 there with a film called Quest, which wound up winning almost every major animation award around the world, including the Oscar. So let me just tell you, let me just summarize this film and then I'll say one or two things more about why it's here in this list. The camera pans right over a wide shot of a desert, arriving at a half-buried bottle and a sort of dirt clump or series of clumps, which comes to life, seizes the bottle and sees that it's empty. The dirt or dark sand rises in a somewhat human shape, humanoid, digs around itself a little, and finds itself falling into something like quicksand. No, that is not a mistake. The Sandman, as we will call him, falls out of the sky into a land entirely covered by sheets of paper, one of which flies by. The Sandman stands and walks along the crinkling papers, past a little whirlwind of papers, until one sheaf knocks him down, causing him to notice a soft, wet one on the ground, which he touches, causing him to fall into another tableau. This world is all rocks, including several intentionally built vertical piles of rocks, one of which the Sandman climbs and falls from. The Sandman takes a rock and bashes it into the rocky ground, causing a large crevasse or crevice that swallows him. The next tableau has symmetrical container-like shapes in the distance, but the Sandman is most keenly aware of a saw blade that shoots sparks as it rides along the ground below and maybe trims the Sandman's toes and head, actually. The Sandman walks past some kind of industrial press that seems to be placing more metal panels on the ground. The Sandman sees a distant pool under metal bars on the ground. The metal bars resemble those that they used to cage Roman soldiers from above. So if you've ever seen any Roman set film, including Gladiator, you know that where they had the cage, you know, above the guy's head, you know, heads. Nonetheless, the Sandman finds a way to get down to that level. He sort of sneaks through some metal plates, and then he, once he's down on that sort of lower basement level, he avoids more industrial machines in motion, and finally returns back to the pool he had seen through those bars, which he digs around. By now he must know what he's doing, and in fact he does cause a collapse. And does that collapse let the Sandman fall into it? It's not clear from editing. What does happen is that the pool segues into a sky as the camera lowers into the desert again, where we see the Sandman lying still in the sand, just as we first saw him. Okay, that's the end of the film. It's a short. I have to admit that one reason that this is on this list is because this is the kind of film that these days could only be done digitally. They would never not do it digitally now. I guess you might have one or two filmmakers who are sort of insisting on things not being done digitally, but it's almost unfathomable. This is like, this was done the old way, the King Kong way, you know? And therefore this was 19,000 separate shots in like a 10-minute film, you know? I mean, that's what they were doing at the time, you know, to try to build a little figure. A little kind of sand figure. And it's really, to me, it's very poignant because it has a sort of a life that way. I think that is maybe why it won so many awards, because this is just a year after Toy Story, but clearly there was a way in which the, you know, digital was the way of the future already. That was kind of obvious. I think it's poignant to see this film now and say, oh, wow, they really did do these things before. And, you know, digital is fine, but now that we can kind of do anything, everything's easy and that doesn't seem as transgressive as it might have in the old days. Okay. Now we come to film E98, another cartoon, or really a series of shorts made into a larger short, by Don Hertzfeld. Hertzfeld is this sort of interesting person. He was making cartoons before he really even had a budget for them, just as a teenager, was throwing things together. He has a sort of a warped sensibility. I guess you could say that, you know, after South Park had established this or whatever, he went even further into kind of this land of kind of edgelord stuff, or just, you know, but we like it. It's kind of weird. And so according to Hertzfeld, the Family Learning Channel approached him. He made some movies for them, you know, these very cheap ones, but they didn't like them, but he decided to turn them into a bunch of shorts anyway. So, okay, let's talk about what it's like to see rejected when you're watching it. The film begins with a title card explaining what I just said, more or less, that these shorts were commissioned by the Family Learning Channel, but never aired, hence the title Rejected. The traditional film leader, 3, 2, bleep, precedes each of these mini shorts within the short. A goggle-eyed stick figure next to a bowl says correctly that his shovel-sized spoon is too big. A man-sized goggle, a banana comes on screen, but the banana is kind of the same height and size-ish of the previously established stick figure man. He's got legs. He announces himself. A vacuum noise is heard, and that's it. This kind of sensibility is distinctly, I would call it, avant-garde. After the second 3, 2, 2 stick figures chat with intentionally unsynced lips in a very experimental way, the first asks, "Tuesday's coming, did you bring your coat?" And the other replies, "I live in a bucket." This seems to cause the first man to grow a demon-like head from his head, which the other one likes. He sort of enjoys that as a pig kite floats by. After another 3, 2, bleep, we see a sign saying silly hats only near 3 stick figures who do indeed wear silly hats. A fourth arrives in a top hat and they beat him with brick bats. What? In the fourth mini short, we hear, "You're watching the Family Learning Channel. And now, angry ticks fly out of my nipples," which indeed happens as the swarm surrounds some alarmed kids. In the fifth, 3, 2, bleep, 2 stick figures say non sequiturs, and then, hey-oh, just before one left eye squirts a or spurts a gusher of red blood, which is the first color so far all over the other. So this is now the first time we've seen any color. Well, no, that's not true. We had the banana, the yellow banana before, but mostly this is the only color. And it's suddenly red all over this guy, red dripping blood, who doesn't seem to mind. This other guy doesn't seem to mind. A title card says that Johnson and Mills also commissioned the artist and also rejected the following bits. Three, two, bleep. An alien arrives in a flying saucer, pulls out a man's eyes, and flies away, leaving the man to bonk his head into a yield sign. In the next one, a man yanks the stomach out of another man, causing the man to fall and die in a bloody mess. The man holding this bowling ball-sized bloody stomach places it on his head, waves his spindly arms, and says he feels great. Cut to weird, fat ghost figure saying, in a sort of a talk bubble, now with vitamin C, in front of what we're told is Johnson and Mills bean lard mulch. In the next one, a small figure coos, and walks unsteadily as an off-screen voice says, baby is taking his first steps. It's going well until baby trips at stage right, revealing a staircase of dozens of stairs that baby falls down to some kind of canned applause. Cut to a shot of Johnson and Mills kelp dip next to a kid saying, in another talk bubble, you know, the kinds of that you see in comic books, I am a consumer whore, next to his dad saying, and how? In the next such mini short, clouds with arms and legs dance to another cloud with arms and legs, who is prompting them. And he seems to be having all kinds of fun until Red comes out of his or hit or her or their bottom, as this one says, my anus is bleeding. The other clouds keep dancing cheerfully as the leader seems to drown in their own gushing blood. Cards say that without narrative structure, Hertzfeld's or this author's cartoons began to fall apart. And indeed, we see the figures from the previous bits enduring many calamities of paper folding and crinkling. Okay, that's about it. So this movie, even as a short, and by the way, I mean, the really experimental part is there at the last couple of minutes, as where he really shows off his kind of experimental chops in a way that you wouldn't see in something like a South Park or Simpsons. But anyway, Don Hertzfeld went on to make very interesting films later in the 21st century, but this film did establish him. It got nominated for an Oscar. I mean, it goes to show you can kind of blow people's minds with this sort of thing. And it's they're rudimentary, but they feel sort of intentionally rudimentary, you know? Okay. All right. And now for the final two films of the E-list. Wow. I love ending with these two films. I think these two films are a great kind of final summary of everything that experimental film was, could be. They're wild and weird and interesting and non-narrative and they kind of bring up more questions than they answer, which is just the way I like it. Okay, so E99, Dacasia. Oh, right, I should say one or two things about Bill Morrison. You know, I was looking up Bill Morrison he's kind of a young guy, born in 65, in Chicago, went to Reed College, School of Art, tried on a lot of different things. He definitely has an artist sensibility, as very clear from Dacasia. What's great is that he was able, with Dacasia, was able to get the music, Michael Gordon's symphony, I mean, that's what they're calling it, is really special, is really something that you can't imagine this film without. Let's see. Critic Glenn Kenny described Dacasia as, quote, an abstract narrative about mortality in all of its manifestations, unquote. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on in this thing. I guess Errol Morris watched it and decided it was the best film ever or something. All right, why don't we get to the legacy of the film afterward? I feel like I should summarize it more before. Okay, so what is this film? Ooh. A whirling dervish with arms splayed spins in full view of several men wearing fezes. Weird industrial music plays over that and the next shot of a dozen projector reels set next to each other spinning. The camera pans right to see the dozen strips of celluloid coming out of the reels, going into a pool. Continuing unsettling music as the camera lingers on a cloud wafting near specks. Somewhat like moth-like emulsion is seen in many, many quick blotches, which eventually blotch over a woman in a kimono and then a rocky seashore. Blotches become more vertical. Vertical, yes, more smoky and perhaps creepier, or maybe it's just the music. We see what looks like proteins, close-ups on butterfly wings, and then a real butterfly. Thank you. The emulsified effect finally reduces, though is still present, in an extreme wide shot of a caravan of people and camels walking through a desert. Under emulsive patterns of whirlwinds and dot storms, we see the bow of a Navy ship. Many abstract tempera-like patterns follow, eventually alighting upon some kind of old European garden grounds, where two nuns watch as the walking of a group of brown girls in white uniforms, made creepy by the music, slow motion, and ongoing emulsion. Yeah, it's just like weird. We cut to one girl dancing, her movements absorbed into the general abstract patterns and music. Something similar happens with girls holding hands, boys playing instruments, and Japanese women entertaining. A man pulls a woman out of a river. A man, another man is at a loom near a rural brick wall. He's spinning a water wheel. In a mill whose walls are adorned by large rugs, women spin looms. Okay, in a metal shop, men spin loom-like mechanisms. Yeah, so there's a lot of looms looming around here that you can not always discern that well through the emulsion and the blotches, right? Okay, then in a truly extraordinary shot, I mean, really like one of the best shots in any movie ever, you see this cloudy kind of pulsing emulsion on the left side of the screen, while it seems to be spitting out rockets, like normal kind of live action rockets on the right side of the screen. They look sort of like the rockets from A Trip to the Moon, the old Méliès film, although they are actually part of an old amusement park ride. You know that, you can tell that. But just the swirl, the way it's done, is really, really remarkable. This is followed by another truly breathtaking shot, as carnival goers seem to walk through a cloud of emulsion, almost changing race as in a photo negative and then reverting to the race they started in as they come out of the cloud. So it's like, picture them on the left third of the shot, kind of normal-ish, then they go into the middle third, which is all emulsive, and then they change race and they come back out. I mean, where have you seen this? I mean, these shots are extraordinary for their kind of originality. And you know, I'm not, yes, the whole movie's full of original shots, but those are like, wow. A ghostly rotation of Ferris wheel passengers appears in front of standing passengers. The Ferris wheel spins, and we finally cut back to the opening of a spinning. The Ferris wheel spins, and we finally cut back to that opening of that whirling dervish. A ghostly, weirdly scored negative image of a baby being pulled off of blankets and bathed or perhaps baptized. Emulsion and celluloid patterns frame kids boarding and riding a bus and silent film subjects looking at the camera. Under more evocative damage, a ship seems to be leaving port, with sailors and well-wishers making warm gestures. More celluloid abstractions wallow around people on what look like Western sets. Emulsion splotches set off people engaged in normal 1920s silent film behavior, as well as something that's more tri-corner hat era. Under a vibrating blur of black, the kids continue to walk in the courtyard under the eyes of the nuns. More crazy patterns, more 1920s style imagery, like people lingering on the sideboards of a Model T Ford. Miners mine, but seem almost to react to the messy film distortions. With odd outlines around their bodies, a dozen people trudge into a lake for a baptism. Music continues its metallic creepiness as men harass women. Framed by wavy, curvy lines, miners pull victims out of the mine. In a ghostly negative, a fez wearer checks a mummy in an Egyptian tomb. distortion crescendos, is all I could say. In slow motion, a man climbs a ship's ladder. A stick pushes dirt from side to side. A man films on a high ledge over the city, a bit like the man with the movie camera. Children play as grain seems to fall upon them. A wood house burns and collapses, seemingly because of the contorted imagery. Its embers take on an emulsified life of their own, more black splotch storms over domestic arguments. The watery distortions sometimes pass for flower petals. A lone slow-mo plane lingers in the sky, soon joined by a few others, and then leaving the plane's slow-mo parachuters. A flat field with the sun hanging over it is followed by the caravan across the desert, followed by the nuns watching the children return inside. Splotches dominate shots of lone figures in the Spanish gardens. Without, finally, appreciable emulsion interference, we see a small sun set on the horizon. I mean, the sun looks small in the frame. Back to the blotches to set off a romantic pair and that whirling dervish one more time. Okay. That's about the end of the film, so it's a little more than an hour long. This film was the first film from the 21st century inducted into the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. I think that says something. It is quite an extraordinary experience watching this film. It's, you know, avant-garde down to its toes. It's quite something, you know. It feels like a summary of everything that we've been talking about in many ways. It also is supposedly he didn't add any emulsion. I can't quite believe that. He didn't condition these shots, but I don't know if I believe that. I want to believe it, but I somehow can't because it's just too artistic. Anyway, this guy has gone on to be the chairman of many boards. And, you know, I mean, Bill Morrison has, you know, thanks to this movie, you know, they want to hear from him about all kinds of things. And I love that. I don't know if the Decasia is supposed to be a reference to decaying Asia. I don't necessarily think that's a thing. But it is the context of this coming out within a year after 9/11, even if he started it earlier, is kind of fascinating to me. Okay. Let's start to get this thing, start to wrap it up. So Alexander Sokurov. Wow, we are here at E100. Russian filmmaker, did a lot of things. Had an interesting little career. His film Mournful Unconcern was nominated for Golden Bear in 1987 Berlin Festival. Mother and Son was his first internationally acclaimed feature film. So he was already doing sort of interesting things. He's gone to Cannes a bunch of times. Susan Sontag, already comp of all people, comp gave him some rare compliments. Anyway, but then Russian Ark came along. Now, Russian Ark is this fascinating film. Again, what do we like about a film like this? It's not documentary. It's not narrative. What is it? I think that's one great thing about Russian Ark. Okay, but Russian Ark, I mean, we should say it got a lot of attention because it is a single shot, or it certainly plays like one. It does feel like he got this done in a shot, and it's quite a shot. It's a shot that only a real filmmaker could do, you know, a person with a sense of framing. And, you know, when I try to do things like this, my hand moves too much. Okay, let's just let's get through this. You know, almost let Sokurov have the last word on the whole list, which I sort of like. Okay, so how does this film begin? In darkness, a voice says he cannot recall what happened to him. The shot opens on joyful women being pulled out of a carriage out in the snowy exterior of the Hermitage Museum. Our narrator says, judging by the clothes, it must be the 1800s. These noble women and their attendants enter the building, and we follow them without an edit through darkness and light. The narrator says the officers don't know the way, but wonders if he himself is invisible or unnoticed, or if this has been staged for him, or if he is expected to play a role. A man in black begins talking with the narrator, mentioning that he never spoke Russian before and that Asians love tyrants, including Peter. But our narrator objects to this caricature of Peter. The man in black is apparently French, and our narrator is just Russian. The man in black ascends a staircase, comments that it's like going to the underworld, and enters a room full of bewigged nobles watching a Roman play to the sound and sight of a classical orchestra wearing tricorner hats. The man in black sees Catherine II on his way to leading our narrator through a hermitage hall that he says reminds him of the Vatican and how skilled Russians are at copying because they don't have masters of their own. The narrator mutters that the Hermitage was created to satisfy dreams of Italy. 18 minutes in, the man in black enters a vermilion painted room inhabited by very modern museum goers, for example, wearing backpacks, where the man in black meets a couple of modern experts and they discuss symbolism and issues of curation. Why is this next to this? When the man in black leaves out the way he came, he is back amongst the apparent contemporaries of Catherine the Great. The man in black celebrates a particular Greek-like sculpture. Against the advice of the narrator, the man in black approaches a woman in black, fingering another Greek-like sculpture, and asks her to accompany him to the next salon, where she deconstructs a Van Dyck painting and says, Rubens, Peter Paul Rubens, considered Van Dyck his best pupil. Other people, men, hover around, including a pair of time-lost sailors and three men in tuxedos with raised hands who separate the man in black from the woman, tell him the museum is closing, and usher him into another room. As the man in black walks through empty teal-painted chambers full of paintings, he and the narrator banter over performance and life and hands until the man in black warns the narrator to stay away from him. However, the narrator keeps following the man in black as he accosts a young patron for not knowing enough scripture to appreciate religious paintings. The man in black carries on by himself, muttering about the Tsar and Rembrandt and El Greco, until he comes upon a woman talking to a painting, whom he embraces until she moves away, saying, Das vidanya, das vidanya. Without dialogue, the camera lingers on Baroque paintings, the floor, and then a marble staircase as the narrator tells the man in black just a bit about 20th century Russian history. As the man in black says a republic isn't right for Russia, two guards usher him away toward a door that opens to a sort of storage room that the man in black finds unfamiliar, just before a modern worker ushers him out for stepping on corpses. In the hall, the narrator informs the man in black, who has never heard of Germany, about the millions who died in wars versus Germany. They enter a large royal chamber where Catherine the Great, apparently, chats with several children and is then escorted outside onto a curated path through the snow as the man in black tells the narrator, quote, mortals must not chase royalty. They also often discuss a fire after which the Hermitage was rebuilt. Catherine, if it is her, fades into the distance as the man in black beckons the narrator into a side door into a room where they many are dressed for a period play or masquerade ball, shushing the narrator. The man in black leads him, or us, into by far the largest room yet, a white colonnade-filled throne room populated by hundreds of soldiers and nobles, standing at attention as a Persian emissary, the grandson of the Shah, very formally apologizes to Nicholas I for the deaths of Russian diplomats in Tehran. While the camera is permitted to be a person walking around all of this ceremony, a soldier nudges the man in black and by extension the narrator out into the nearby chamber full of tables of food, where the narrator asks if the man in black remembers the taste of food. The man in black compliments the Winter Palace and remarks that Strauss was a good architect with discipline, who nonetheless allowed these room to breathe. After waiters chase the man in black into the next darker room for the film's second time, we are very clear, well, maybe third time, we are clearly in the present, with three men in suits talking about what happened 10 years before, which is a clear reference to the Soviet Union breakup. And as the narrator explains it, about the ongoing surveillance of the director. The man in black moves into the next lighter room where he judges some period soldiers in formation, while the narrator claims he made up what the modern men in suits were discussing. We follow five well-coiffed, ethereally dressed girls laughing and prancing down a hall as they pass, apparently a regal Anastasia accompanied by a nun who discharges the girls and sets Anastasia into some kind of ceremony. A small one in this case, with just a few people. With the man in black nowhere in sight, the camera enters a rather opulent ballroom, maybe an even larger room than that throne room, full of formally dressed Catherine-era nobility, as well as an actively playing orchestra. The man in black reappears to chat with a few nobles as the narrator comments that the man can't hear him, but he'll see him later. One could call the cameraman narrator a sort of a fly on the wall, except that he's always at about head height and moving at the speed of a normal human as he drifts among the dancing bourgeois until he finally comes upon the man in black, who is dancing with a young noblewoman while making an aside to the narrator that there must be 3,000 people here. When the orchestra finishes, all of these people, however many there are, vociferously applaud, and then they slowly file out, with the exception of the man in black, who dismisses the narrator's ideas of leaving and going forward, saying he's staying. The narrator says, "Farewell, Europe." The narrator files out quietly with the nobility for several minutes until he comes upon a side door that opens to, of all things, a wintry ocean. As the camera ventures into this open water, he narrates, quote, "We are destined to sail forever, to live forever," unquote. That's the end of Russian Ark, and that's the end of the experimental list. We've gone from E1 to E100. I sort of want to let that final line linger. I think it sums up a lot, so I don't want to say too much. I don't know when I'm coming back. This has been a great season for 2024. I will be back, but it'll be at some point in 2025. Thank you for listening to all this. Go out and see some experimental films so we can add them to the next ones. And I'll see you for another season that may not actually be the F list. I may move to a slightly different list, so look out. Until then, save me some popcorn, because there's always another movie to see.